So I don't know how appropriate this is. Probably not very appropriate, but hi Esther, it's been so long. And hi Valerie, my new great grand sponsee. It's so nice to see everybody in the room. So before we get started, I'll just give you my name, rank, and serial number again, as I do every week. My name is Carrie. I'm a recovered alcoholic. My home group is the New Horizons Group in beautiful Bend, Oregon. And I'm currently living in the disciplines of 10, 11, and 12 to the best of my willingness on most days. So we are in, finally, there is a solution. So page 17 of any big book. Today I am still working out of the book that we're studying in this literature study, which is the abridged version. I call it the study edition, because it has everything in it that, is meant to be studied. And it has large margins for notes and it's large print, so you can work out of it with a couple of different people at the same time. And so let's just go ahead and start with there is a solution. Now, I love that this first paragraph on page 17 comes right after Bill's story. And just as a recap, in case you're coming and joining with us for the first time in this series, what we've already read so far, what we read last week, I should say, is Bill's story. And for anybody who's read Bill's story, it's like this really, I mean, tragic story of a man with so much potential. Let me know if I start cutting out. A man with so much potential, and he ends up, kind of, well, not kind of, definitely a low bottom drunk, seemingly hopeless. And after he was on the gates of death, his higher power saved him and put him on this path to recovery. And he got sober and then helped a ton of other people. And he had this productive life, and it's beautiful, right? And I love the way that that Bill's story ends with how basically faith has to work 24 hours a day and through us or we perish. And that's what he does. Like that is his primary purpose. And he died sober. And so the very next thing that we read going into chapter two is we of Alcoholics Anonymous know thousands of men and women who were once just as hopeless as Bill. So we're picking up off after this terrible story of this low bottom drunk who was saved, and they're saying that he's not the only one. There's thousands that were just as hopeless as Bill, and here's a promise. Nearly all have recovered. They have solved, past tense, the drink problem. Now, if that isn't a bold statement, I don't know what is, right? Because they could have worded that in 100 different ways that would have given some leeway. But they didn't. It's very clear. Nearly all have recovered and they have solved the drink problem. Not they managed to be staying sober one day at a time. They've solved the drink problem. And so I love that you're just given this, we are just given this big dose of hope right from the beginning of the chapter, right? So it goes on to say, we are average Americans. All sections of its country and many of its occupations are represented, as well as many political, economic, social, and religious backgrounds. We are people who would normally not mix, but there exists among us a fellowship, a friendliness, and an understanding which is indescribably wonderful. We are like passengers of a great liner the moment after rescue from shipwreck, when camaraderie, joyousness, and democracy pervade the vessel from steerage to captain's table. Unlike the feeling of the ship's passengers, however, our joy in escape from disaster does not subside as we go our individual ways. The feeling of having shared in a common peril, and I have common peril highlighted, and this is part of a math equation that I will give you the answer to here in a minute. Common peril means common problem, right? Not a similar problem, the same problem, is one element in the powerful cement. I have powerful cement. That's another equation of this math equation, which binds us. But that in itself would have never held us together as we are now joined. The tremendous fact for every one of us, and I would love to encourage you to look up the word tremendous, because there's a lot of facts in this book, right? The great fact, the first fact, the real fact, this is the tremendous fact for every one of us, is that we have discovered a common solution. Common solution is the third highlight. So the math equation is, what does common peril and our common solution equal? It equals the cement that binds us, the powerful cement which binds us in unity. And that's our fifth tradition, right? We have a common peril. We struggle from alcoholism, not gambling addiction, not drug addiction, not sex addiction, not eating disorders. We struggle with alcoholism. Every one of us has that. And if we stick to that as the common problem, and then we stick to our common solution, which is the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous outlined in this book, then we will be able to, us drunks can hang together forever, as Bill says, as Bill puts it. And because we're not going to be diverted from all of these outside problems and outside solutions, you know, exercise routine is great. Yoga is great. A diet and exercise plan is great. Essential oils are great, but none of that is AA. That's not our common solution. So as long as we can stick to our common problem, peril, and our common solution, we will be bound together in that powerful cement. And so how? Well, the next line tells us, we have a way out on which we can absolutely agree and upon which we can join in brotherly and harmonious action. This is the great news this book carries to all who suffer from alcoholism. Wouldn't that be amazing? Wouldn't that be wonderful, right? And we can judge and we can throw stones and we can say, you know, well, of course it was the, it was, everybody absolutely agreed when this book was written and they joined in brotherly and harmonious action, but now it's many years later and we have new medical, you know, we have new this, we have new, we have everything new. And it's like, no, myself, I can do all of those additional things outside of the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. And the big book tells us over and over again, the outside help is good. Outside literature is good. Outside issues are not going to tear us apart. But they're called outside because we keep them outside of the safety of our common peril and our common solution, which is why Alcoholics Anonymous works. So I can throw stones. But really, all I am in control of, and I, you know, don't want to sound too Al-Anonic here, but all I'm in control of is, what am I sharing in an AA meeting? What am I sharing with my sponsees? I know that my own sponsor shares a lot of stuff with me, right? She hasn't eaten sugar in like 13 years or something like that. And she has a lot of helpful stuff. But whenever she shares something with me, Experience, Strength, and Hope outside of this book, she always, and she forgot one time when she told me to put blueberries in plain oatmeal with plain yogurt or something like that. Like, I started eating this and she called me back and she says, I just don't remember. I did tell you that has nothing to do with AA, right? And I'm like, yes, Beth, thank you. Like, she's very good at making sure that when she gives a suggestion that's not in the book, she makes sure I know it's not AA and it has nothing to do with AA. And I'm grateful for that. So I'm going to go to page 18, full page. And I wish I could read this whole chapter, but we don't have time tonight. And the parts that I skip through, are 100% as good as the parts that I'm emphasizing about. And there's not enough time. So I'm just going to skip down to highly competent psychiatrists who have dealt with us have found it sometimes impossible to persuade an alcoholic to discuss a situation without reserve. Strangely enough, wives, parents, and intimate friends, people who you would think are the people we would go to talk to, right? People we trust, usually find us even more unapproachable than do the psychiatrists and the doctors. Here we go. But the ex-problem drinker who has found this solution, who is properly armed with facts about himself, can generally win the entire confidence of another alcoholic in a few hours. And until such an understanding is reached, little or nothing can be accomplished. And that's reiterating what the foreword to the second edition says over and over again, that only a recovered alcoholic can help another alcoholic. Men of medicine, men of the clergy, parents, wives, intimate friends, there's a wall, right? Until another alcoholic tells you that he pees his pants when he drinks. And it's like, all ice melts away. So the man that is making the approach, and this is talking about the 12th step here, the man that is making the approach has had the same difficulty. Again, not a similar difficulty, right? The same difficulty that he obviously knows what he's talking about, that his whole deportment shouts at the new prospect that he's a man with a real answer, that he has no holier than thou, no attitude of holier than thou, nothing whatever except for a sincere desire to be helpful, that there are no fees to pay, tradition 8, that there are no axes to grind, no people to please, no lectures to be endured. These are the conditions we have found most effective. And after such an approach, many take up their beds and walk again. Now, I don't know if anybody has ever, gone to a doctor or a treatment center or a counselor, and you're sitting across the table and they have their notebook and they're asking you questions and they're taking notes. And even if they're an alcoholic, even if they're in recovery, it's like, there's a secondary purpose there. You know, they're getting paid to tell me something. They're getting paid to help me. They have an intent. They have an agenda, right? And so it's kind of like, I don't have that. There's not that magic there. But when another alcoholic sits across the table from me for fun and for free with nothing to gain except for wanting to help me, that's when the magic happens, right? None of us make a sole vocation of this work. Just gonna real quick throw the definition of vocation out. It's career or occupation. And other places in this book and in AA literature, you'll hear the term avocation. Avocation is the opposite of vocation. Avocation means for fun and for free, right? And vocation means for fee or for hire. Vocation means career or occupation, where avocation means nothing to gain, hobby, something that I do that has no monetary value. So none of us make a sole vocation of this work. This is tradition 8 here. Nor do we think its effectiveness would be increased if we did. That was what I was talking about, sitting on the other side of the table with someone who, without anything to gain except for the sincere desire to be helpful. We feel that elimination of our drinking is but a beginning. A much more important demonstration of our principles lie before us in our respected homes, occupations, and affairs. All of us spend much of our spare time in this sort of effort, which we are going to describe. That's the 12-step work that we're going to describe in this chapter. A few are so fortunate enough to be situated that they can give, not charge, nearly all their time to the work. That's like me. I give a lot of my time to the work, but I have never accepted a penny. And I've been offered jobs in the, recovery industry. And for some people, that's right. For me, it wouldn't be right. I couldn't do it. I'm going to skip down a little bit. We have concluded to publish an anonymous volume, okay? Setting forth, that's this book, setting forth the problem as we see it. We shall bring to the task our combined experience and knowledge. Now that's the key, right? That's the key that makes this whole thing work, because some people have experience, right? You could have 40 years of experience drinking and you can come in and be, you know, a wet drunk in the meeting and you got the experience, you know what it's like to be an alcoholic, but without the knowledge of how to recover, you're not going to help anybody, right? And, or you could have all the knowledge in the world. You could have gone to school for, you know, being an alcohol counselor. You could have a degree. You could know this book by heart, front and back, but without the experience of being an alcoholic, without the experience of taking a drink and being, having a complete inability to stop drinking after the first one, all the knowledge in the world is going to avail nothing. And so it's that, that magic, the two part, right? The combined experience and knowledge. Now we read on the opposite page, the page 18 at the same exact height in the page. So about 3/4 of the way down, it says that same exact thing as the combined experience and knowledge, which is my highlight, in the italics on page 18. The ex-problem drinker, so there's the experience, right? You're an ex-problem drinker. You've had that experience. And who's found the solution, so you're a recovered alcoholic, who's properly armed with facts about himself, the knowledge. Those two components are necessary to get to achieve success with a prospect. So this should suggest a useful program for anyone concerned with a drinking problem. Now, of necessity, this is tradition 10, there will have to be some discussion of matters medical, psychiatric, social, and religious. We are aware that these matters are, from, well, their very nature, controversial. Now, nothing would please us so much as to write a book which would contain no basis for contention or argument. We shall do our utmost to achieve this ideal. Most of us sense that a real tolerance of other people's shortcomings and viewpoints and a respect for their opinions are attitudes which make us more useful to others. Our very lives as ex-problem drinkers depend upon our constant thought of others and how we may help meet their needs. So, this is, for me, tradition 10 has no bounds, right? Everybody gets to decide where their spiritual practice is on these principles. For me, the further I practice tradition 10, the more that it encompasses, the more I find myself in a position of neutrality around issues naturally, race, politics, religion, all of that stuff, right? So one of the things that I'll tell you here is, it says that most of us sense a real tolerance of other people's shortcomings and viewpoints. Like, I can go out to lunch after the meeting with Irving. Irving's in the room. He's from my home group. Him and Davey and I go out to lunch at the Thai place a lot of the time. And you know, and I can go out to lunch with them and maybe we can talk a little bit about lightweight politics or lightweight religion. We don't, because I don't, because that's where I have decided to hold my level of anonymity when it comes to the 10th tradition. But we could, and I don't think that it would go anywhere. I don't think that it would cause any damage, because we're recovered alcoholics, right? And we sense a real tolerance. However, if I go out and the newcomer is with us and I say something stupid, well, smart in my head, but you know, if I say something or even post on my Facebook wall, if I'm going to accept friend requests from newcomers, something that could indicate that, I am either pro-life or pro-choice, right? Or I don't know, Republican or Democrat, or an atheist or a Bible thumper even. I mean, and this is not for you. This is for me. This is for me. I have decided that I don't get to do that where I am in my program, because as the next line says on page 20, our very lives as ex-problem drinkers depend upon our constant thought of others and how we may help meet their needs. And if something I say puts a wedge between me and being helpful to someone else because they see my viewpoints as wrong, then I'm not being of maximum service to God and those about me. I might still be able to be of service, but this is where I am still growing, right? In my understanding and effectiveness. And if my very life as an ex-problem drinker depends on this, then I start to type something on Facebook because I am opinionated like the rest of them, probably more so. I start to type something and then I'm reminded our very lives, God damn it. And I have to delete it, right? I don't post it. You may already have asked yourself, why is it that all of us became very ill from drinking? Doubtless you're curious to discover how and why in the face of expert opinion to the contrary. Expert opinion. So let me read that again. Doubtless you are curious to discover that how and why in the face of expert opinion to the contrary, including people even in AA, we have recovered from a hopeless condition of mind and body. Some people say you don't ever recover. Some people say that we stay sick and suffering every single day until the rest of our life. Some experts say you're hopeless. There's nothing we can do for you. But in the face of expert opinion to the contrary, we have recovered from a hopeless condition of mind and body. If you are an alcoholic who wants to get over it, you may already be asking, what do I have to do? Well, the next line says, it's the purpose of this book to answer such questions specifically. Specifically. Which means clear cut, specific, not in a general way. We shall tell you what we have done. Before going into detailed discussion, it may be well to summarize some points that as we see them. And I'm sure we can all relate to this. How many times have people said to us, I can take it or leave it alone. Why can't he? Why don't you drink like a gentleman or quit? That fellow can't handle his liquor. Why don't you try beer or wine? Just lay off the hard stuff. His willpower must be weak. He could stop if he wanted to. I mean, she's such a sweet girl. I should think he would stop for her sake. The doctor told him that if he ever drank again, it would kill him. But there he is, all lit up again. Is he insane? Well, these are commonplace observations on drinkers, which we hear all the time. Back of them is a world of ignorance and misunderstanding. Why? Why is it ignorant and misunderstanding? We see these expressions refer to people whose reactions, here's a highlight, are very different from ours. So again, what is the definition of an allergy that Silkworth kept talking about in the doctor's opinion? It's an abnormal reaction to a food or substance. So this is saying that normal people have reactions that are very different than ours. So of course they're not going to understand. Their reaction is normal. We have an abnormal reaction. So of course they're not going to understand why we can't just have two drinks and leave it alone. Of course they can't understand why we can't quit drinking. They can, and they don't have any problem with it. Their reaction is very different than ours because we have an abnormal reaction. Moderate drinkers have little trouble in giving up liquor entirely if they have a good reason for it. They can take it or leave it alone. Then we have a certain type of hard drinker. Now, every time this book mentions the word hard drinker, anytime any of our literature mentions the word hard drinker, it's talking about the non-alcoholic. He may have the habit badly enough. This is the hard drinker. And we know, right, that alcoholism isn't a habit. Addiction might be a habit. You can use your way into any addiction. But alcoholism, like, I have an abnormal reaction to alcohol, and I have since the first time I tried alcohol, and I wasn't addicted to it. It had not become a habit. So he may have the habit gradually enough to gradually impair him mentally and physically. It may cause them to die a few years before his time, right? This person who is maybe has the habit badly enough that he is getting physically addicted to alcohol, and he has if a sufficient strong enough reason, however, ill health, falling in love, change of environment, the warning of a doctor becomes operative, this man can stop or moderate, although he may find it difficult and troublesome and may even need medical attention. So this person who just got themselves physically addicted to alcohol might even need to go to detox, right? But they can stop or moderate because alcoholism is not an addiction. I mean, a lot of alcoholics end up physically addicted to alcohol later on because it's an addictive substance. I didn't. I never had to go through detox. I never had to go through the DTs. I didn't have to. I got off the elevator before that, right? A lady down the road, five houses down, when I first got sober, I just yelled it from the rooftops to anybody who would listen, right? I did not know the traditions. Anyways, she must have heard me yelling it. I must have told her one day at the mailbox or something. Because a couple years later, like I'm 2 years sober, and this old lady's knocking on my door. She's in her 80s, right? And I open the door and I'm like, yeah, I'm thinking she's trying to sell something. And she's like, do you still go to those AA classes? And I'm like, oh yeah, why? And she's like, well, I think I might be an alcoholic. And I said, oh my God, come in. Why? You know, I mean, this is a point in time where I'm 12 stepping everybody. You don't even have to be alcoholic at this point. I just want you to, you know, taste that till mudslide ice cream, basically. But so I invite her in and I'm telling her, like, well, tell me how much you drink and how often do you drink and all of these things. And I don't know how to 12 step somebody. I don't know at this point that it doesn't matter how much she drinks or how often she drinks or how long she's been drinking for. Those things have nothing to do with alcoholism. What alcoholism has to do with is what happens when we drink, right? So I'm asking her all of these questions that have nothing to do with alcoholism. And she's telling me, well, I drink every night. And I'm telling her, oh my God, every night? I didn't even drink every night. You're probably, you're definitely an alcoholic. How much do you drink? And she says, well, a glass of wine. I'm like, oh yeah, like a glass of wine, like big glass. And she's like, oh no, like a regular glass of wine, a bottle of wine takes me sometimes 3 or 4 nights to drink. And I'm going, what, you don't get like drunk? Like, when's the last time you got drunk? And she goes, oh my goodness, I got drunk once in high school and I would never do that again. I got so sick. And I'm like, what? Cause she's shaking. She's shaking. She's going through DTs. She's going through detox. But she's not an alcoholic. And I couldn't even figure it out. I'm like, I don't know. Like, maybe you got to talk to your doctor. Like, I was just, I had no answer for her. And so she goes to the doctor and she comes back. So her doctor told her what happened was her doctor, she was going to get a hip replacement. And her doctor told her she can't drink any alcohol for 48 hours before the surgery. And so she quit drinking. And she didn't have any problem mentally with it. She has no, you know, she didn't have that compulsion. She didn't have any of that. She just was having trouble detoxing because she had drank every single night a glass of wine, I guess a normal size glass of wine, for the last 50 years. And so her body was physically, it had been become physically dependent on it. And so she went to the doctor and she got her, you know, she went through her detox and she got her surgery and she's fine. She says she's not going to drink ever again, every single night like that. And I saw her a couple years ago. And I said, how's that not drinking thing going? And she's like, oh, it's wonderful. I never want to become addicted to alcohol again. Now I only drink, you know, on the holidays. And I had a glass of champagne at my granddaughter's wedding last month. I don't get that. Like, that's not, you know, she doesn't have that abnormal reaction. She can stop or moderate, even though she found it troublesome, right? And may even need medical attention. So the next paragraph, this is me. This entire next paragraph, it's a small paragraph. This is how, for me, this is how I help the prospect to qualify if they don't know if they're alcoholic or not, because this was me. But what about the real alcoholic? Well, he may start off as a moderate drinker. He may or may not become a continuous hard drinker. So you don't even need to become a hard drinker to be a real alcoholic. But at some stage of his drinking career, he begins to lose all control of his liquor consumption once he starts to drink. That's me. It don't matter how long I've been drinking for. Doesn't matter how much I drink when I drink. It doesn't matter how often I drink. What matters is what happens when I drink. That's the qualifying paragraph. And then the biggest paragraph in the entire big book is right after. And I'm not going to read it all because it goes through many different symptoms that some of us have, some of us don't. And at the very end of that paragraph, the very next paragraph explains why I'm not going to read it. The Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, which I was part of, but it goes through a bunch of stuff that you might be able to relate to, you might not. And the reason I'm not going to read the whole thing, aside from time, is it says this is by no means a comprehensive picture of the true alcoholic, as our behavior patterns vary. But this description should identify him roughly. And I identify with probably, I don't know, half to three quarters of that paragraph, the long, long paragraph. Why does he behave like this? If hundreds of experiences have shown him that one drink means another debacle with all of its attendant suffering and humiliation, why is it that he takes that one drink, right? That's insane. Why can't he stay on the water wagon? What has become of his common sense and willpower that he still sometimes displays with respect to other matters? Right? Where alcohol is concerned, we've been strangely insane. Perhaps there will never be a full answer to this question, to these questions. Opinions vary considerably as to why the alcoholic, here's another highlight, reacts differently from normal people. Because remember, what is an allergy? It's an abnormal reaction to alcohol. So of course, I'm going to react differently than normal people. Page 23, these observations, however, would be academic and pointless if our friend never took that first drink, thereby setting the terrible cycle in motion. Therefore, the main problem of the alcoholic centers in his mind rather than in his body. So if I was allergic to a strawberry, I would have a one-step program, right? It would be, oh my gosh, when I eat strawberries, I have an abnormal reaction to them. I break out in hives, my throat swells up, I can't swallow. So I have a one-step program. I admit that I'm powerless over strawberries and that my life becomes unmanageable when I eat strawberries. So I just flat stay away from strawberries, right? And I don't have there's not a second component to it. So it would be academic and pointless if an alcoholic could say, oh, I'm allergic to alcohol. Okay, then I'll stay away from it. Because unfortunately, with the alcoholic, no matter how many times we say we're staying away from that first drink, we pick it up again. So these observations would be academic and pointless if we could just simply not take that first drink in the first place. Because with the strawberry, we don't go down to the ice cream shop and sit and watch them make strawberry shakes going, well, maybe if I just have a strawberry shake with artificial flavor, I could have strawberry. No, we just stay away. It's a one-step program. We don't need 11 additional steps to relieve where this problem really is, which is in my mind, between my ears. Yes, I have an allergy. No, I'm never going to get rid of that allergy. I'm never going to be immune to alcohol. I'm never going to be able to drink with impunity. But if I don't pick up that first drink, then that's not a problem. The allergy is not the problem, right? Because the allergy only happens after I pick up the first drink. So why do I keep picking up the first drink? It's because of what goes on up here. So the solution needs to be a solution for up here, because there's never going to be a solution for my allergy. So now I have to find out what to do with this. And that is where steps 2 through 12 come in. And that is why, that's how the problem is removed. Right. So, if you ask him why he started on a last bender, chances are he will offer you one of 100 different alibis. Sometimes these excuses have certain plausibility, but none of them really make sense in the light that the havoc an alcoholic's drinking bout creates. They sound like the philosophy of a man who, having a headache, beats himself on the head with a hammer so that he can't feel the ache. If you draw this fallacious reasoning to the attention of an alcoholic, he will either laugh it off or become irritated and refuse to talk. Once in a while, he may tell the truth. I love that. Once in a while, an alcoholic may tell the truth about their drinking. And the truth, strange to say, is usually he has no idea why he took that first drink than you have. Some drinkers have excuses with which they're satisfied part of the time, but in their hearts, they really don't know why they do it. Once this malady has a real hold, they're a baffled lot. There is the obsession that somehow, someday, they will beat the game, but they often suspect they're down for the count. I was sponsoring this girl. She did nothing. I mean, nothing. She was going to meetings, right? She wasn't doing any of the work. She wasn't doing book work with me. She wasn't doing anything. And she shows up to get her 2-month coin at my home group. And she comes in and she's drunk. She doesn't think that I could tell that she's drunk. And that would be mortifying if she took her 2-month coin while she was drunk, right? So she sits down by me and I'm like, what are you doing here? And she's like, I'm getting my 2-month coin today. And I'm like, let's go outside to talk. Because, the birthdays are at the beginning of the meeting. And I'm like, oh, no, she's going to want to take a dirty coin. So we go outside to talk and I'm like, I'm not going to let you take a dirty coin. Like, I can tell that you've been drinking. And she's like, no, I haven't. And I said, okay, if you want to take a dirty coin, that's fine, but I'm not giving it to you. And she just starts crying. And she's like, it's coming up with all these excuses. And, she's rattling off all these excuses. Well, I think that it was because of this and then because of this. And she's like, so I guess, and I'm just letting her go. And she goes, I guess this means that you can't sponsor me anymore. And I said, oh, sweetie, if you could have stayed sober for these past 2 months without doing anything, then I probably wouldn't have much to do in sponsoring you. You probably wouldn't even be a real alcoholic. Like, this just means that I can sponsor you. I mean, of course. And you don't have to make up all these excuses. If you're a real alcoholic, you drank because you're an alcoholic. Like, that's what we do. There's no mental defense against that first drink. I said, now, if you want, we can get to work. This is good. Maybe this needed to happen to give you that gift of desperation, right? And that's what this is saying. It's once in a while, he may tell the truth. She didn't want to until I called her out on it. But the truth is, they have no idea why they took that first drink. That's alcoholism. I drank because I'm an alcoholic. That's the only reason. I drank when I was sad. I drank when I was happy. I drank when I was mad. I drank in the celebration. Everything. So skipping over. Okay, so page 24. The fact is that most alcoholics, for reasons yet obscure, have lost the power of choice in drink. Well, wait a minute. Then how are you supposed to put the plug in the jug? I don't know. Our so-called willpower becomes practically non-existent. Well, then how are you supposed to, even if, like, I have some willpower, right? That's what happens when I play the tape through, when I remember my last drink, right? Well, we are unable at certain times to bring into our consciousness with sufficient force the memory and the suffering and humiliation of even a week or a month ago. So I can't play the tape through? Not if you're a real alcoholic. No. So I can't put the plug in the jug? If you could, why would you need AA? We are without defense against that first drink. The almost certain consequences that follow even taking a glass of beer do not crowd into the minds to deter us. If these thoughts do occur, they are hazy. So if I do try to play that tape through, right? If I do think the drink through, they are hazy and readily supplanted with that old threadbare idea that this time we shall handle ourselves like other people. There is a complete failure, not just a failure. These words are put in there on purpose. There is a complete failure of the kind of defense that keeps one from putting his hand on a hot stove over and over again. Right? I know what happened the last time I put my hand on that hot stove, but I can't bring into consciousness with sufficient force the memory of the last time I did it. When I was getting sober, I would come in to the rooms every 3 to 5 days with my tail between my legs and think I was a failure, think I was stupid, think I had weak will, think I wasn't listening enough in AA meetings. Think, how did this happen again? How did this happen? I thought I had put the plug in the jug. I thought that I remembered my last drink. No, if I'm a real alcoholic, those things, they might be okay for the heavy drinker. They might be okay for somebody who had just gotten addicted to alcohol like my neighbor. But I need a spiritual awakening. I need that problem to be removed because I can't bring in to my consciousness with sufficient force the memory and humiliation of even a week or a month ago. I am without defense against that first drink. So the alcoholic may say to himself in the most casual way, it won't burn me this time, so here's how. Or perhaps he doesn't think at all. How often has some of us begun to drink in this nonchalant way and then after the third or fourth pounded on the bar and said to ourselves, for God's sakes, how did I get started again? Only to have that thought supplanted with, well, I'll stop with the sixth drink, or what's the use anyhow? Good news, though, on page 25, there is a solution. So the first half of this chapter is like outlining that I'm not just screwed, I'm really, really screwed. I'm not just screwed bodily, I'm also screwed mentally. And I'm not just screwed mentally, I'm also screwed bodily. And now that it has driven that home, it finally says, but there is a solution. Almost none of us liked the solution, right? Because the solution contains the self-searching, the leveling of the pride, the confession of shortcomings, which this process requires, doesn't suggest, it requires those things. And for anyone who's new or nearly new, those things are 4 through 9. That's what those things are, the confessions of shortcoming, leveling of pride, confession, all that stuff, for its successful consummation. So let's read that again. Almost none of us like the self-searching, the leveling of our pride, the confession of shortcoming, which the process requires for its successful consummation. The process has a consummation. Let's look up the word consummation. Completion. Finish. Fulfillment or an ultimate end or goal. I thought we don't graduate. We don't graduate AA, but I do become recovered. This process of recovering from alcoholism absolutely has a consummation. And thank God, because recovering from alcoholism is the hardest thing I've ever had to do in my life. And I've given birth. A speaker, one of my favorite speakers, and she's passed on now. She used to say that there were three different phases of her alcoholic development that she's lived through. One of them was being an active alcoholic. One of them was being a recovering alcoholic. And one of them was what she said, called herself a recovered alcoholic. And she said, there's only one of those three phases of my development I will never do again. I don't have another recovery in me. I might have another drink in me, but recovering from alcoholism, and I identified with her when she said that, it was the hardest thing I've ever had to do. The leveling of the pride, the confession of shortcomings, the self-searching, cleaning up the wreckage of my past, that's 4 through 9. Now I get to live in the disciplines of 10, 11, and 12, which is also a very difficult task. Some days are better than others, but I never have to go through that process again. Unless I throw it all away, unless I relapse, and then I'm on step one again. Right. But that's what the word consummation means. But we saw that it really worked in others, and we had come to believe in the hopelessness and futility of life as we had been living it. When therefore we were approached by those who, here's another highlight, in whom the problem had been solved, right? ED past tense. There was nothing left for us but to pick up the kit, the simple kit of spiritual tools laid at our feet. We have found much of heaven. Oh, goosebumps. And we have been rocketed into the fourth dimension of existence of which we had not even dreamed. Oh my God. So good. So good. So I'm going to stop there, and we're going to get through the second half of the chapter next week. Little heads up. We're going to be going also next week through the spiritual experience, appendix 2. So if you want to pre-read that, we're going to be spending some time there next week.
All audio and video files on the District6AA.org website or the District 6 in Area 15 YouTube channel are for personal use only. Reproduction, distribution, and commercial use are not permitted. In accordance with District 6 current practice, no faces are shown in our videos and audio is scrubbed for anonymity prior to publishing. Contributors whose voices are heard have given record and release consent. Opinions expressed by the presenter are their own and do not necessarily represent the group conscience of District 6 as a whole.